The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. This week, we're speaking with people who try to deal with an important human characteristic, freedom and information. As part of our church's social teaching, we kind of believe that freedom and information are critical to the dignity of the human person. Freedom, a person should be allowed to exercise their free will in theological terms and in a variety of ways. And our first guest is going to be Vanessa Tucker, who is at Freedom House. She is a vice president there, and she does analysis there. And so we're going to speak with her in a few minutes. And then a little bit later on in the show, I'm looking forward to speaking with two guests, Danielle Weisberg and her co-founder of The Skim, Carly Zakin. And they have founded The Skim, which is a news blurb or news blog or a news report or a newsletter, however you want to say it, in which they kind of put together in a very entertaining and nice way some of the most important news items that are in the news each day. So I'm looking forward to speaking with them. And so it's an interesting time for freedom, and it's also an interesting time for news. So, you know, we sometimes don't think about the freedom of the press in this country. We almost, in some senses, take it for granted. And this has not been an easy time for press and journalists who have been covering different parts of the world. So let's go to our first guest. Our first guest is Vanessa Tucker, who is the vice president of Freedom House. And Vanessa Tucker, thank you for joining us on Just Love.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, I'm delighted that you are here. So, you know, let's just start. So how's freedom going in the world?
Well, I hate to tell you, but we just released our most recent edition of Freedom of the Press, and the news is really bleak.
Yay, not good.
Yeah, not good at all. So global press freedom declined in the past year to its lowest point in more than 10 years, and beyond that, we're also noticing that the rate of the decline is actually also accelerating. So things are bad and they're getting worse faster than they have in the past.
We should have had you on a couple of years ago when it wasn't so bad. We could have been in a more upbeat thing. Now, how long have you been at this, working here at Freedom House?
I've been working at Freedom House for about 4 years, and unfortunately, in that
It's declined, huh?
Good news. There hasn't been a lot of good news to report. I hope I don't have anything to do with that.
Well, you know what I say all the time? I say, kind of, you know, God's in charge of world peace and justice, and I'm not sure he's doing such a good job. So, I mean, you know, we gotta get better at this stuff.
Well, I hope things do get better. I have to tell you, it's not fun to be delivering this kind of news every single year.
Well, you know, Vanessa, just give our listeners a little bit of background. How'd you get into press freedom in the news? How'd that kind of catch your interest?
Sure. So I oversee all of our different publications here along with a colleague, and my background, I grew up in the Middle East, and I've always been really interested in kind of international politics. And after getting a degree in international relations, I decided that I wanted to kind of be in between research and policymaking. And that's a place that Freedom House's analysis is sort of well-suited right there in the middle. So we produce information and research on a range of issues related to freedom. So we produce Freedom in the World, which looks at political rights and civil liberties in every country in the world, and also this Press Freedom Report that I just mentioned, which looks at press freedom in every country in the world. It's not just research, though. What we're looking at is a way to systematically understand how these issues are changing over time. And we look at that through the lens of what can we do better. And then we take those findings and deliver them to policymakers here in the U.S. We talk to governments across the world. I'm about to leave on a trip to talk to policymakers at the European Parliament and also some groups in Oslo and Norway to talk about what we can all be doing better. So we're really looking at not just research to see how things are going, but how we can use that to make things to improve the situation.
I often say that you got kind of two types of researchers in the world. You got the kind of the sociological researchers who want to get smart and understand everything, and then you got the ops researchers who kind of come out of other parts of the world and they want to figure out the information that can help make the world better. They're not as much into the analytical research for the sake of getting smarter. They want to make our world better. And if I kind of misinterpreted what I heard you saying, I think you're in the business of not only understanding, but trying to make the world better by what you analyze.
Right, right. I mean, that's certainly what we try to do is gather information and bring it to the right people and present it in the right way so that they can use it in order to improve policies, in order to improve relationships between groups, in order to improve access to information so that we can actually do something about the problems that we're identifying.
So give our listeners a little hint. How do you judge, what criteria do you use to say that there's less freedom of the press now than there was last year or 4 years ago?
Sure. So I'll give the simple answer, and if anybody wants all the details, if you go to freedomhouse.org, you can find the in-depth description of our methodology with all of the questions and the scores and all that. But just to give a kind of a bird's eye view of it, we look at three aspects of press freedom. The legal dimension, so the ways in which the laws in a country impact freedom of information and of expression. The political environment, so that's how do the political controls over content of media, that's both state-owned media and privately owned media, how do those affect the quality of that information? And then the third category is the economic environment, which is an area that I think is often underestimated. This is about ownership, about subsidies, about all of the ways in which the economic dimension of a system affects access to information and freedom of expression. So,
now, Vanessa, from in the United States, is that kind of issues that oftentimes maybe our listeners would see in the newspaper about the Federal Communications Commission deciding whether or not a particular merger creates too much of a monopoly? Or is that kind of in the area that third area is talking about?
Exactly. That's exactly it. So ownership is a big part of press freedom. You can have a range of private owners of different media outlets, but if those owners are, if you have a smaller and smaller group of owners, for example, and if those owners have a clear political perspective, which most of them do, I mean, they're people, they have interests, they have relationships. If you have a smaller and smaller group, that means that there are typically fewer and fewer viewpoints in the news that you see coming out of that. So in a much bigger media market, that, you know, the closure of one newspaper or one news channel would have less of an effect because you have so many channels that maybe it's just one out of 100. But in smaller media markets in particular, you see that when there's a closure and there are fewer and fewer owners, the access to a range of viewpoints also decreases.
You know, Vanessa, I'm not as kind of a world traveler as you. I'm in New York, so I got a little New York jadedness and cynicism. But so the question I always kind of ask when the business people kind of tell you that there's this firewall between them and the editorial people and stuff like that, I kind of say, well, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, in your kind of analysis of this, are those real, those firewalls, or is it kind of like we try to pretend that we can divide the commercial side from the editorial side? And how does that impact the freedom of the press?
Sure. I think that this varies across countries and also I would imagine across cities and states here in the United States. That's the ideal, right, is that there's a complete division. But it's really hard to maintain that division very clearly in practice. So in things like hiring decisions, who do you keep on? If there's an editor who's continually printing stories that are uncovering a corruption scandal and saying this is really a problem. We need to go after this politician. This guy needs to resign, etc. You know, there are two sides to every story, and it might be that the owner of that paper is hearing from people in his political or his business circle, this is not fair. This corruption, so-called corruption scandal, isn't true, and this guy is going after the wrong people. Well, the editor who's printing that might get fired. He might get, you know, not promoted or not somehow held back. And so it might be from the owner's perspective, look, I just think he was engaging in irresponsible journalism.
Right.
But that's one perspective. It may, you know, they have a difference of opinion. And what that means in the end is that the perspective of the owner might end up being reflected in the people that he's hiring.
We're speaking to Vanessa Tucker, who is the vice president for analysis at Freedom House. And Freedom House is involved in trying to provide some analysis information and information in front of policymakers who can kind of advance the cause of freedom throughout the world. Vanessa, you do more than just press freedom. You deal with a lot of other areas of freedom in your work, don't you?
Yes. So we also, like I mentioned earlier, we also have a publication called Freedom in the World. We look at political rights and civil liberties in every country in the world, and that's a 40-plus years old publication. And as with the Press Freedom Survey, what we do with that information, we have researchers that are external. They're consultants that work for us. They live and work typically in the countries that we're asking them to analyze, and then we check in with them each year. What's the status of a long range of issues and questions that relate to political rights and civil liberties? How has that changed? We sort of translate all of that research into a major index that looks at all of these questions, and then we rank out the countries so it's 209 countries and territories that we look at, and then look at what are some of the big threats to freedom, what are some of the big threats to protection for human rights around the world, and then we sort of take that show on the road, and we go to speak with policymakers, with civil society groups and others to better understand the kinds of things that are happening and how we can respond from a policy perspective. So that's the main publication. And we also do a few special reports. We have a publication on internet freedom. So there's a lot going on.
Now, so tell me, I mean, we got the bad news with regard to freedom, media freedom. If we go to the broader issue of kind of generally political freedom in the world, up, down, what's going on there?
Well, I hate to tell you, things are...
Oh, no!
Things are similarly bad when you look at the broader perspective. The downward trajectory continues, and it's very similar to the trajectory in press freedom. They seem to be quite related. If you're looking for positive news, what I can tell you is that there's been... You know, we've been talking a lot. People have been talking for years about the role of technology and how is this really changing things. And social media is so widespread, and people are using it as an activist tool. And while there are a lot of complications to that, what we can tell is that people are much more aware of what's happening around them, what's happening in their country and in the world, and they're using that information to be much more active. So whereas decades ago, you might see that opposition parties, that political opposition is the main area that's pushing for change. We see that across the board, particularly in civil society, which is kind of the organizations, the civic organizations that are not, they're not affiliated with the government. It's just people who are getting together and pushing their governments for change.
So, Vanessa, let me now kind of move in this direction, because I was intrigued by this, and I think I'm going to have to maybe being even a little bit more depressing. But but you brought up the social media issue. Mm-hmm. You know the Middle East well. I mean, everybody talked about the Arab Spring, and you wrote, you know, not too long ago that, like, the last case is worse than the first case in terms of repression. So it seems like it worked and it didn't work, at least in Egypt. Is Is that, did I read your article correctly?
Egypt has been, you know, certainly not a positive case, unfortunately. As far as it relates, I think an important point about social media and all of these cases is that social media is a tool, and it can work both ways. So it can both work to connect people and to help people organize and to get more information and to use that information to push for reform. And we saw that in the uprising in Egypt, that people used those tools. But it can also work against that kind of effort. For example, when the government it's very easy to monitor social media. So it's really easy to know who's talking to who, what they're doing, and to identify sort of change makers and the people, the troublemakers that are trying to push for reforms and that are really leaders in that effort. It's easy to find those people and to shut them down. So we found, I think Egypt's a really good example of a government that is using technology against sort of civil society and change makers in general in order to silence them. So I think that we still have to take the victories where we can. So we have to give credit to all of those people who are trying so hard and using everything they can, including all these new technologies, to push for change. But we can't assume that now that these technologies are available, that means that change is inevitable. The struggle really does continue, and it continues despite all these new tools.
Now, let me ask you about the social media issue, and I got the point about they leave big fingerprints that can be tracked down, and not only afterwards, but even probably in real time. But but is some of the stuff that kind of I've read or picked up in the media that a lot of the organizing, a lot of getting people to mobilize quickly in various different places was a result of the ability to use social media to communicate with broad groups of people?
Yes, I think that it's really been used as a tool. I mean, in Egypt, across the Middle East, certainly, and really across the world, it's been a tool that allows people who might not have had access in the past to a range of views because the papers are censored, the radio, they're getting kind of the state line through all of the major venues where you get news. But social media has given them the opportunity to see cases that they wouldn't have heard about before. I mean, we've even seen that here in the United States, that social media tools are a lot of what is spreading information, for example, about police brutality. People are taking pictures and are sending it out. Those might be cases that people would not have known about if fewer people had cameras on them all the time now in their phones, and if fewer people had the ability to send those pictures to thousands of people at once. So that's really where the big difference is the ability to collect information that people wouldn't have had access to before and send it out immediately without a political filter, without an economic filter, and with very little. I mean, it doesn't cost anything, really.
We're speaking to Vanessa Tucker, the vice president for analysis at Freedom House, who has a great deal of familiarity with the Middle East and has kind of reported on the issue of freedom, media freedom, and not good news that it's kind of going in the wrong direction, and not such good news in terms of political freedom either. That it's not going in so much of the good direction. Vanessa, any good news?
I think the biggest, in my day-to-day working here, what I find to be the best news and the most exciting is to see people who are continually, despite this kind of resurgence of authoritarianism, despite all of these new threats and this ongoing negative trajectory, the extent to which people consistently put their lives, their families, their well-being, their economic well-being, they put so much at risk in order to push for change. And that, to me, is what is really exciting, is that there are just so many people who continue to push back against these very powerful governments. And in so doing, I mean, they really put so much at risk. So I think that continuing, that people continue to push back despite those risks is should be a huge area of hope. And an area that we encourage people to take note of those cases and to continue to support those people in any way they can.
You know, Vanessa, if I might kind of translate what you've said in another way, is it just seems that there's something innate in kind of the human spirit or that just wants to be free. I mean, it just seems to come so very, very naturally that people don't like to be, and I'm going to use simple words, to be told what to do by somebody else. They want to be able to kind of express themselves in whether it is in their culture, whether it's in their speech, whether it be in their religion, whatever it is. There's almost something in the human spirit which kind of wants to be free. And I think even when there's oppression, it tries to find a way to come out. And I think I think that's what you're pointing at. And I guess that may be the most hopeful thing, that we do have, you know, more than a few billion people in the world, all with a kind of a spirit to be free. And if we could figure out how to do it without killing one another, that would be a nice thing, too.
That would be great, yes.
Yeah.
You know, I completely agree. And I think that sometimes we hear from people saying, oh, well, you have a very American viewpoint. You have a very Western viewpoint. And our methodologies are based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is a global document. It's, you know, but I think that it's really important beyond that to remember that these are not, it's not an American or a Western value that people like to have a say in what happens in their daily lives. People may not use language related to democracy or sort of Western democracy in order to express that desire, but when there's a public safety problem, when they don't have information about the products that they feed their children or the trains that they ride to work, that kind of thing, people all over the world want that kind of information, and they don't like it when their governments keep it from them. That's not a Western value. It's, I would argue, a human value. People want information about their lives. They want to make decisions about their lives. And though that decision-making might take different forms, that kind of freedom is a universal value.
You know, Vanessa, I thank you for your time, but I hope that you would come back, because what I'd like to speak with you a little bit more about is that notion, Western, Eastern, and what you kind of said in the last little sentence, it may take different forms. Mm-hmm. I think is an idea worth exploring, because, you know, one of the things about in the United States, since we have people from so many different countries who settle here, oftentimes I think some of the misunderstanding may come from different forms that maybe similar values take. And I think freedom might be one of those. So I'd love to talk with you more about that sometime if you'd give us the opportunity.
I'd love to come back whenever you'll have me.
Great. Vanessa Tucker, Vice President for Analysis at Freedom House, thank you for taking the time to be with us. And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back on Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, and we say just love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Jesus didn't have Facebook or Twitter 2,000 years ago, but if he did, he would totally be a fan of the Catholic Channel. Jesus would create a Facebook and Twitter account and instantly like and follow the Catholic Channel. So, if you want to do what Jesus would do, like or follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Here, you can connect and get even more new information that the Catholic Channel provides to you every day. Go to facebook.com/thecatholicchannel and like us or follow us on Twitter @CatholicChannel.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Why do Catholics confess their sins to the priest? Because that's the way Jesus ordained it. Where's that in the Bible? Well, let's start in Mark 6, verse 7. Jesus sent out the 12 two by two and gave them authority over unclean spirits. Here Jesus is giving out his authority. In Matthew 9, 2 through 8, we see that Jesus has authority on earth to forgive sins. Then in John 20, 21 through 23, Jesus breathes on the apostles, conferring upon them the Holy Spirit, and sends them out as the Father has sent him. with authority on earth to forgive sins. He states it clearly in verse 23, whose sins you forgive are forgiven them, and whose sins you retain are retained. Now, how would they know what sins to forgive or retain? Only if they were told. The apostles and their successors, our priests and bishops, have been the ministers of God's grace and forgiveness for 2,000 years, because that's the way Jesus ordained it. I'm Gus Lloyd. Join me weekday mornings from 7 to 11 Eastern for Seize the Day on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Recently, there has been some confusion between the Catholic Channel and the similar-sounding The Crossword Puzzle. We would like to clear this up. The Catholic Channel reveals the Word of God. A crossword puzzle has you reveal words on your own based on clues. The Catholic Channel has different shows throughout the week. A crossword puzzle is, let's be honest, something you really only do on the weekend. The Catholic Channel is easy to listen to for hours. A crossword puzzle is oftentimes difficult and impossible to finish. The crossword... I mean the Catholic Channel. Sirius XM 129.
Christopher Minutes, thoughts on making every day count. I'm Tony Rossi.
In 2003, Wall Street analyst and consultant Debbie Yee was enjoying a vacation in Mexico when she got the phone call that changed her life. Her sister Christine had her leg ripped off by a New York City subway car after falling into the gap between the train and platform. Debbie told the New York Post that she slept in a reclining chair by Christine's hospital bed for a month and observed the genuine compassion of her doctors and nurses. She realized that she wanted to save people's lives too and decided to become a doctor. Dr. Debbie Yee's work in New York Presbyterian Hospital's ER went on to be profiled in the Christopher Award-winning documentary series New York Med, on which she displayed a compassion for patients that was grounded in her own past. I'm Tony Rossi. Join me Sundays at 7 a.m. or 11:30 a.m. Eastern for Christopher Close-Up on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love, just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and if we do that, our world will be more just and more compassionate. This week, we're talking a little bit about freedom in the world. We just spoke with Vanessa Tucker, who is the Vice President for Analysis at Freedom House. And in a few minutes, we're going to speak with the co-founders of The Skim, which is a, I call it, it's a electronic online newsletter. That might not be the right term, Daniel Weisberg and Carly Zakin. And we're going to speak a little bit about how the news comes across these days, because two of the values that make us kind of better as a world is freedom and good information, and they're a related commodity, and commodity might not be the right word, but they are related if we're going to kind of have a world which is more free, which people have information, and hopefully using the information to be more just and more compassionate. And, you know, so I think, why don't we go to our guests right now, the co-founders of the Skim, Kali Zakin and Danielle Weisberg. Thank you so much for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you so much for having us. We're very excited to be on.
Well, I am too. Now, I have to begin with a little bit of an admission. I had a very good friend who actually a number of years ago did a little bit of kind of media coaching with me, and probably maybe it was last summer. You're going to have to help me with the time on this. She sent me the Skim and said, you gotta follow this. This is great. And in my typical New York cynical way, I looked at it once and I said, come on, there are all these things out there. I don't have to look at it. So I didn't. The first time she sent it to me, I just looked at it and I put it aside, and she bothered me again and she said, you got to read it. And I said, no, I don't have to read it. And then one night I was having trouble sleeping and I read it. And I said, you know, I got to admit it, this is worth reading. So I was not an easy convert to the Skim, but now you've gotten to my list where the only thing I have a little complaint, though, it's a little bit late in the morning because I'm up before then. You do it at 6 a.m., I think, don't you?
We do, 6 a.m. Eastern, so we're up when our audience is up.
Great. Hey, could you tell us a little bit, how'd you get the idea for doing this?
Yeah, this is Carly talking.
Great.
Thank you so much for having us on. So Danielle and I were former NBC News producers. We grew up in that building in 30 Rock in New York. We interned there throughout college. We worked there full-time as producers after college. Between the two of us, had really worked in almost every news division. And we, you know, obviously saw traditional media was changing, especially when we started work full-time in 2008. It's no secret, not only was every industry going through a hard time, but media in particular. And, you know, we really would worry about what is our path, you know, where is our longevity here? And separately, we used to just, you know, get brunch as friends. And what we found is that our friends and family would come to us every single day and say, what happened in the world today? And we realized, you know, we used to kind of trade these anecdotes, but we realized our friends and family were not getting information in a way that they actually enjoyed or engaging with. And when we kind of put together that fact with the fact that we were concerned about where the future for ourselves was in media, we realized we had an opportunity. And we ended up quitting our jobs and launching an email from our living room couch.
That is absolutely wonderful. That is a great story. Any regrets?
No. That's a great question. I don't think we have time to think about regrets. But, you know, I think that the biggest regret that we would have had was not embarking on this. And every day is tough and it's different in its own way. But we really, I'm very happy that we took a bet on ourselves.
Hey, can I just share with you something a little bit serious for a moment? What I get really annoyed about with news and things of that nature is that that so much of it is, in my words, okay, biased. I mean, I could name names, and I might in a little bit, but I mean, you just read the headline, and some of them, you know, the story is not true. You don't have to read the rest of it. But you know what I love about your stuff? You know, from my perspective, it's pretty straightforward. It's not biased. I mean, and I think that's a real contribution that you make. It tells the information in a relatively straightforward way. So thank you for that.
No, thank you so much for saying that. You know, for us, our mission is to make sure that people are educated about what's going on in the world around them. We do not take any political stance whatsoever. For us, we're really telling you the information you need. In a straight way, but we do that in a way that's also conversational.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have my own little blog, which and I've called it Just Love, which is my blog. But basically, the subtitle, I basically say when I talk about religious things, they need to be relevant, not reverent, because you got to get people to figure out what's going on. And I think that's what you do. And let me point out just today you did a little piece on the cancer charity scandal, the misuse of a lot of money. And I got to tell you, I just thought that was a very fair presentation of what was going on. And from my point of view, and I admit my own bias on this, that you ended it with a little thing saying, hey, this doesn't mean you shouldn't give to charity, but just check them out before you do it. And I thought that was just so fair, as opposed to some other places where the conclusion would be, see, they're all crooks.
Thank you. I think that's a great note. And I think one reason why we thought to do it that way is that we are lucky enough to have an extremely engaged user base. So they talk about what they read in the scam and they tell their friends. And we didn't want, you know, the takeaway to be all charities are bad. And, you know, the news sometimes is depressing. And I think that's the easy takeaway. But we definitely recognize that there's a great responsibility that comes with telling people what's going on in the world. And what we try and do is put it in perspective. So I think that story was a great example that, you know, hey, maybe don't direct your funds to these charities, but, you know, there are a whole bunch of great ones out there that you should look at. And I think, like anything, we want to make sure that what goes to our audience is vetted. So, you know, finding places that we trust and giving them access to our user base is something that we really think about.
Well, you know, let me say that, because that's what, you know, your background is in news. And by your own self-admission, you're news junkies. And one of my complaints about some of the stuff that gets posted is it's unvetted, unrefereed, and more times than not, wrong and misleading. And that's, I think, the problem we got with this horizontal ability for everybody to get their things out there. So that's why I like what you do. I mean, you bring a professionalism to it, but in a way that's not stodgy. And so thanks for doing that.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that.
But I got to tell you, you know what my favorite story today was? And I got to know, you got to give me the background, whether it was a real scandal. Flatgate.
go ahead. Yeah, I think Flatgate, you know, as we said today, I don't think that a woman thought of that rule. it's really so random. You know, I think it's just such a funny thing that's going on there. But, you know, if I were stopped at the red carpet at Cannes, I wouldn't be too happy.
Hey, if I got to Cannes to be stopped at the red carpet, I would be happy.
The problems in perspective.
You're like, yeah, but I'll tell you the reason why I really kind of like that one. I discovered recently that the Our Father, which is kind of our quintessential prayer from our Christian Catholic perspective, I discovered that the Our Father is give or take about the length of two text messages. That's all it is. And so my new criteria for prayer is that nobody should use prayers that are longer than either two text messages, and one text message is enough. But why did that catch my attention? That caught my attention because a couple of weeks ago when I was preaching, I came up with a few text prayers. And you got to be practical when you're praying to God. And I said, so this prayer was for practical prayer about shoes. And I said, thanks God for the shoes. They look great, but could you not make them hurt so much? And when I saw that Flatgate, I said, that's my prayer for Flatgate. So, but anyway, either one of you, how do you decide what goes in it each day? Because what do you use, about six or seven different stories each day?
Yeah, you know, we don't have a set number of stories. We definitely have days that are shorter and days that are longer. The beauty of writing and the platform we do, which is email, is we don't have specific airtime or real estate that we have to fill. So an email can be as short or as long as we want it. Our real kind of litmus test or threshold every day, or filter, if you will, is would our friends talk about this and would they need to talk about it? So that's a really great filter for us of discerning when something might feel like it would belong on an evening newscast versus when something feels more practical that our friends would actually utilize. So our goal is you can read the skim every morning in under 5 minutes, go to any social event, any professional event, and talk to anyone about anything.
Well, you know what I say? When I talk to people, I say, this is good cocktail party information.
Yes.
That you can pass it along, and it's really, it's kind of easy to pick up. What's some of the favorite stories that you've kind of put in there? What was one of your favorite ones that you put in there?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think we both would have a similar answer, which is we love doing election coverage. And again, not because we take any political stance whatsoever, but our mission is to make sure that people feel educated and to make sure, it's a gift and a privilege to be able to be in a democracy and to have the ability to vote. And it kills us when people don't vote. And so our goal is to make sure that everyone does go to vote, whether it's a midterm election or a general election. And, we love doing our election breakdown and election coverage the last few years because really we're just telling you the basics and the facts. And I think we just the amount of thank yous that we get after that, is just kind of our more rewarding days, I would say.
Hey, did I pick up something recently in the skim? And maybe I missed it from the beginning, but did you just pick up a sponsor?
Yeah, we all this week have been sponsored by Chase and yep. have done a great native campaign where our skim girl at the top of our masthead has gotten a logo, and we've been able to bring, with the help of Chase, some great credit tips to our audience.
Oh, that is great. That is good. So that's a good advance in publishing the newsletter. You got some notoriety from a big bank from it.
Yeah, it was exciting for us. We're definitely in a really big growing phase right now, so it's really exciting.
I also noted that every now and then you've included either a quote from Pope Francis or something. I guess what I'm amazed at, and I'd like your take on this, how does this 77-year-old guy whose speaking voice is not terribly whatever, but it seems like whatever he says gets picked up in an incredibly positive way by the media.
So I actually think that's been one of my favorite stories over the past year is just following Pope Francis. And I think it's been incredible, the media coverage he's gotten. And I think it's really interesting that he knows or he intentionally speaks in sound bites sometimes.
Yep.
We can pick up quotes that are pithy and that we can run with. And that have, modern connotations. I think the last thing he talked about was the mob. We used a quote from that around Easter. And it's just, he's been able to really reach an audience, whether it's through, speaking kind of casually or speaking in a way where it gets picked up and they can hear what he has to say and, under a sentence and move on with their day. But I just think he's done, through getting out of a car in the middle of a crowd, he's just been able to really interject himself in the media in a positive way in a really short amount of time. So that's been one of my favorite stories to cover.
Well, and I think what he gets and what you get are the fact that there's no way that brief isn't better and short works and long doesn't work. And I think that's one of the things that he's managed to figure out, that we in religion and we got a thing to really think that we got to go on for ages and ages. And the more boring the document is, the must be more holy or more solemn. And I think he's figured out the opposite is true. And I think that's why people are able to pick up what he says. I don't care, Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, who's your favorite politician for good sound bites?
Oh, for good? Well,
Joe Biden. Yeah. He was born to give us sound bites.
obviously, like, you know, there's no secret. He's been giving, like, late night comedians fun for the last few years. He just has some great zingers every now and then. So we love any good ones we can get from him.
Yeah, he is. I mean, actually, my own personal opinion is I think that Joe Biden sometimes gets a bad rap for some of the things he says. Some of the things he says are, yeah, they're a little bit like, maybe he shouldn't have said it. But the reason why I think he stands out is because all the rest of them are so programmed to not say anything that could be quoted that when he says something, it just stands out there as something that is quotable. So I tend to agree with you. I think he's easily quotable in a lot. But you got to admit. In an entirely different category, one of the best sound biters was Sarah Palin.
Yes, definitely. Not quite as brief, but definitely, yeah, had some good sound bites. And I've heard, I was just reading Politico the other day, and they were talking about how Senator Bernie Sanders had some great social media game going on between quotes and pictures. I haven't checked it out yet, but that's another one I'm hoping will turn into some good quotes for 2016.
So what are your favorite news sites to kind of look at?
The Skim.
Yeah, after that one, and after you sign the conflict of interest policy, let's go on to some others.
You know, honestly, one of the things about the Skim and our editorial process is that we actually don't tell each other what we read.
Okay.
It's part of what we keep our editorial process fresh. We each like to say we read everything, and not to sound like a politician we just named, but we really think we do. I think you know, we're really careful to really read not only obviously the mainstream news sources, which there are no surprises there, but also really like niche industry blogs and you know, really, and I would say different verticals. So, but Danielle and I have never shared our daily news consumption habits with one another.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I read much more news now since stuff is online. I mean, I hated to turn newspapers. It was just like, whatever. But now it's so easy. Now, the other thing I will have to kind of confess to you, what is also good about it is you can go down and see the headlines. And I know that 95% of those headlines I don't care about. So you can kind of skim the headlines. And sometimes I'll remember the headlines because if I'm going to someplace, I can at least say, oh, boy, there was an article about. I can't say anything more than that. So it's, but what I like about the online stuff is, since my attention focus isn't too great, I oftentimes the best, most interesting things are the other stories that appear kind of down the right hand side or the left hand side or on the bottom of what I'm really reading, and then I never finish what I am reading. So I think having stuff online really has increased the amount of information, good, but sometimes bad, but mostly good. So anyway, so I just want to say, hey, thank you so much, Carly and Danielle, for being with us. And I just appreciate what you do. And thanks for the contribution that you make. And, you know, sometime in the future, maybe you'll come back because I enjoyed our conversation. And thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
Great. Carly Zakin and Danielle Weisberg, the co-founders of The Skim, an online newsletter that comes out every morning at 6 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And they bring the news to us in a way that's readable and a way that we can kind of get into it very, very quickly. Why don't we take a break? I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. It's Just Love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Can a Catholic believe in evolution? In Catholic thought and teaching, there is some latitude on this. Regarding the evolution of species, the fossil record and scientific facts support that animals do evolve. So, did man evolve from apes? The Church allows for the possibility that man's body developed from previous biological forms under God's guidance, but it insists on the special creation of his soul. Pope Pius XII, in his encyclical Humanae Generis, declared that the teaching authority of the Church does not forbid recommended that research and discussions take place with regard to the doctrine of evolution in as far as it inquires into the origin of the human body as coming from pre-existent and living matter. But the Catholic faith obliges us to hold that souls are immediately created by God. The important thing to remember is that God created everything out of nothing, and at some point, he decided to create man different from all of the other animals and infused an immortal soul in our first parents, separating them from all of the other animals. I'm Gus Lloyd. Join me weekday mornings from 7 to 11 Eastern for Seize the Day on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
This is Father Leo Padalinga, host of the movement GraceBeforeMeals.com. I'm sure you're all familiar with the story, the Good Samaritan, who inspires us to a simple act of hospitality. Hospitality because it actually creates for people a little mini hospital. Do you hear how the words are connected? That means basically when you offer hospitality, a roof over someone's head, a place for them at your table, and of course the companionship, you bring healing to a weary soul. As a matter of fact, hospitality, although not a theological virtue, is certainly a grace by God to bring healing to this world. If we were to take a look at all of the people who are just wandering around aimlessly, maybe it might compel us to make room in our hearts for them, which is what I do by strengthening relationships around the dinner table. And you can learn more at gracebeforemeals.com.
Recently, there's been some confusion between the Catholic Channel and the similar-sounding The Canvas Satchel. We would like to clear this up. The Catholic Channel offers a fresh, new perspective on God's Word. The Canvas Satchel is an old, worn-out messenger bag. The Catholic Channel is a convenient place to hear topical things going on in the world. The Canvas Satchel is a convenient place to put things from the world. The Catholic Channel is always there when you need it most. The Canvas Satchel is often tossed in a corner and lost under dirty laundry. The Canvas Satchel... I mean the Catholic Channel. Sirius XM 129.
Christopher Minutes, thoughts on making every day count. I'm Tony Rossi.
The love between a boy and his dog can be a powerful thing. Consider 7-year-old Owen Hawkins and his 3-legged Anatolian Shepherd, Hatchie. Owen was born with a rare disorder, which leaves his muscles in a constant state of tension. Hatchie was a disabled and abused dog found tied to a train track in North London. The dog was rescued and offered to Owen's stepmother, Colleen. In the documentary, A Boy and His Dog, she explained, "There was an immediate bond between Owen and Hatchie. It was like they both knew the other was different, and there was an instant acceptance of those differences, and that they were going to work as a team." Owen says Hatchie changed his life for the better. The boy concludes, "He does look after me, and he's special." I'm Tony Rossi. Join me Sundays at 7 a.m. or 11:30 a.m. Eastern for Christopher Close-Up on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. This is our weekly conversation. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself. You know, Tom, we've been talking about news and freedom, so let's share with our listeners. What do you got in terms of some news for them?
Well, you know, Monsignor, today I think people should be aware when they listen to Just Love about justice in the world. Down in San Salvador, in El Salvador, Archbishop Oscar Romero is now, as we speak, being beatified. And as you may remember, Monsignor, or be aware, he was the Archbishop of El Salvador. He was killed by he was saying mass actually back on March 24th, 1980, when he was assassinated. He was a great talker and a great advocate for the poor and the vulnerable during a very brutal civil war that was going on back there. Currently, he has been he's being beatified, and it's interesting. He is almost a new category of martyr, Monsignor. It used to be that only people who were martyrs were those that died at the hands of those who hated the faith as the faith. In other words, they killed you because you were Catholic. Romero, in a sense, has been recognized as a martyr because he's dying as a victim of those who hated the fact that he was giving charity and advocating on behalf of the poor. So he's a little bit of a different kind of martyr, but a martyr nonetheless.
You know, I've read that, Tom, and I'm not sure I agree with that.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I hear that, and that's what everybody says, but he was saying mass, right?
Absolutely.
And he was preaching the gospel of justice, the gospel of compassion, in a context in which that was not accepted.
Exactly.
Well, I think they may have not liked the faith too much because that's what he was preaching. Well, so anyway, but that is interesting. And again, because sometimes the category between politics and between moral voice sometimes gets a little bit blurred, I think, you know, people, it took a while to realize his value and for him mm-hmm. to move into that status of being canonized as a saint. So anyway, so we've been speaking about freedom in the world. We've been speaking about the media, and we've been speaking about how we get news in a way that we can understand it and deal with it so that we can kind of make our lives better. And with freedom, with good information, if we act on it correctly, our world will be more just and more compassionate. So thank you for being with us on Just Love. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
You're listening to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.